Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The UN Security Council has for the first time adopted a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded by cancelling meetings between Israeli and US officials. From Washington, Gary O'Donoghue reports.
This is a significant step for the UN, which has been deadlocked for months over endorsing calls for a ceasefire. 14 countries voted in favour, with none against. The United States said the resolution threatened the diplomatic efforts currently underway to negotiate a deal. Nevertheless, Washington abstained, allowing the resolution to pass. A spokesman for the National Security Council, John Kirby, expressed disappointment that Israel had cancelled a high-level visit to Washington this week in response and insisted US policy hadn't changed.
The governing coalition in Senegal has congratulated the opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye on winning the presidential election. Provisional results showed Mr. Faye had a strong lead over the former Prime Minister Amadou Ba. Mr. Faye was in prison less than 2 weeks ago and campaigned on a promise of radical change. An appeals court judge has granted Donald Trump an extension to pay a much-reduced penalty in a fraud case in New York. From there, Neda Tofik.
This was really the court throwing Donald Trump a Hail Mary, a lifeline, right as he was due to have to pay more than $500 million to make sure that the attorney general wouldn't come after his assets. Letitia James was very upfront and blunt about the fact that she would aggressively move to seize his assets. What this court order means is she no longer can do that while his appeal plays out. Instead, Donald Trump has been allowed to pay this much reduced amount, a bond for $175 million. And by all accounts, we do expect that he will be able to get that bond.
Separately, Mr. Trump will face the first ever criminal trial of a former US president 3 weeks from now in connection with hush money payments to a porn star before the 2016 election. Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden says hackers affiliated to the Chinese state were responsible for two malicious cyber campaigns on the Electoral Commission and MPs. Here's Rob Watson.
Mr. Dowden insisted they had not succeeded, but that for the first time ever, Britain was imposing sanctions in response to a cyber attack. But many MPs ridiculed the government's response as underwhelming, with one likening the scale of the sanctions to an elephant giving birth to a mouse. The government insists it does take the threat from China seriously, but its policy remains one of seeking to engage with Beijing as well as warning it.
BBC News. A Russian court has remanded in custody three more suspects over Friday's deadly attack on a Moscow concert venue. Their two brothers, Dilovar and Amichon Islomov, who are Russian citizens, and their father, Israel Islomov, who's a Tajik national resident in Russia. They're accused of terrorism-related offences. Boeing's chief executive Dave Calhoun is stepping down by the end of this year. He's been under pressure ever since an exit door on an Alaska Airlines Boeing 737 plane blew off at about 16,000 feet and the aircraft was forced into an emergency landing. Michelle Fleury is in New York.
Obviously, the company felt it had to do something. It was under increasing pressure, not just from the financial sector, but you also saw from government officials and indeed from its customers. And I think that's why you've got Dave Calhoun, for example, saying he is going to step down, falling on his sword and trying to kind of address some of the criticism that has been levelled at this company.
The opposition candidate in Venezuela's presidential election might miss the chance to enter the race as the deadline for registration expires later on Monday. Karina Yoris said she hadn't received the necessary codes to enter her name on the National Electoral Council website. The 80-year-old university professor said her rights as a Venezuelan citizen were being violated. She stepped in as a substitute after the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was barred from running on charges of corruption. President Nicolas Maduro is set to file his own candidacy for a third term. An Afghan media group has urged the Taliban to release a journalist who was taken into custody in the northeastern province of Kunduz. The Afghan Journalist Centre said Abdullah Ahmadi was detained with three colleagues on Sunday, but the others were released after a few hours. It's believed he was filing for an Afghan media outlet based abroad. BBC News.
Hi, my name is Vicky Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans home ownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Home Ownership 101 and answering your questions live.
Good afternoon and welcome to Madison BookBeat, your home for Madison authors and authors coming to town. I'm Lisa Malowski and I'm the fourth week host for today's Madison BookBeat. My guest, Anne Garvin, PhD, is the USA Today bestselling author of five funny and sad novels. She writes about people who do too much in a world that asks too much from them. Anne worked as an RN after receiving her PhD, taught exercise physiology, sports psychology nutrition, stress management, and global health for 30 years in the University of Wisconsin system. She currently teaches creative writing at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and has held positions at Miami University and Southern New Hampshire in their Masters of Fine Art creative writing programs. Anne is the founder of the multiple award-winning Tall Poppy Writers, where she is committed to helping women writers succeed. She is a sought-after speaker on writing, leadership, and health, and has taught extensively in New York, San Francisco, LA, Boston, and at the festivals across the country and in Europe. Anne's current book, There's No Coming Back From This, was published by Lake Union Publishing in 2023. It is my great honor to welcome Anne Garvin to the airwaves. Welcome to Madison BookBeat, and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thank you, Lisa, and thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad to hear that. There are a number of plot lines running through There's No Coming Back From This. We have Poppy, who is on the verge of losing her home, when an old flame, now a hotshot producer, gives her a surprising way out, a job in costumes on a Hollywood film set. It is a bold move to pack up her bags, keep secrets from her daughter, and head to Los Angeles. Poppy, the Midwesterner, has a lot to learn about the fast and loose world of movie stars, iconic costumes, and backlot intrigue. There's No Coming Back From This reminded me of a light, fluffy omelet unfolding in your mouth as the character named Poppy ran the show and provided humor along the way. Your book references several Midwestern things in addition to direct references to Madison, Wisconsin. I think of your book as a perfect book to be carried by Leopold's Books Bar Cafe on Regent Street.
Mm-hmm.
Where they specialize in Wisconsin-themed books. Is your book there?
Yeah, it is there.
Please tell us how you worked all the Midwestern details into your book.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm originally from the East Coast, but moved steadily Midwestern my whole life. And so even though I have some, you know, memories of growing up and spending a lot of time in New York with my family and that kind of thing. I think that I am solidly a Midwesterner. So it's not hard for me to weave those things in, especially when I am transplanted to another place. Like, I spend a lot of time writing in LA because the sun is there during the winter months and I have a whole group of friends there. And so I'll go there just to write. And so whenever I'm doing that, I'm writing and viewing the place from a Midwestern's point of view. And so some of the things that I wrote about in the book were just my way of taking a look at the things that are happening in LA. Like, one of the things, I think I even said it in the book, but I'm not even sure, but I'm sure I said it many times to friends when I was in LA. And that is that, like, LA has a lot of homelessness, like so much more than Madison does. And
I've
in Madison,
that.
Yeah, you know, like in Madison, if someone's laying on the side of the road, you call the ambulance and you stay with them until someone's come
Absolutely.
And pick them up and you know where they're going and you're hoping that everything is going to be well. It doesn't matter who you are. If you see that, you're going to do that. At least in the Midwest or at least in Madison.
Right.
But in LA, you really have to walk past them and you don't call the ambulance because there's so many. You'd be on the phone all day. And they're working on that problem there. But for me, seeing this, viewing the things in a different way, like from a Midwestern point of view, it was
right.
very easy to see a difference and then kind of bring them up and talk about them. And I think that, you know, really, I think people understand what it's like to be displaced in the world all the time. Like, we move
sure.
all over the place. We're nomadic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, oftentimes we could take a look at another world and see how it's done, and we can do it in judgment, or we can kind of do it with a little curiosity and humor.
Right.
And I always default to the humor probably to make myself feel a little more comfortable.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I'm sort of ribbing everybody. You know, like teasing LA a little bit. I'm teasing Wisconsin a little bit. And I have a great love for both of them.
Right.
So there isn't, you know, I think when people read it, they don't see it as sort of a snarky humor. It's more of a kind of like, oh my God, do you see that kind of thing?
Yes,
and I think
it is.
Other people will sort of experience it in that way. At least that's what I hope. I really
yeah,
hope
no, I
that's how
say,
people see it.
I read the entire book and I would say that's exactly how I experienced it.
Yeah. I don't, you know, people are different all the time. And
sure.
I love that people are different. If people weren't different, my books were pretty dull. You know,
right.
I always say I like a good weirdo. And
yeah.
when I say that, I mean, we're all weirdos. And so I don't have any hate for anyone that
right.
has a different sort of way.
Yeah.
But I do think sometimes those ways are very funny.
That's very true.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Anne Garvin about her new book titled There's No Coming Back From This. I'm your host, Lisa Malowski. And you are listening to WRT 89.9 FM. I love being one of the Madison BookBeat hosts, and I'm enjoying my time today with Anne Garvin. You spent weeks in Los Angeles meeting with costume designers, set costumers, celebrity dressers, and wardrobe staff. How did this research help you with writing your book?
Well, I couldn't have written it without them. I didn't know anything about it. I knew nothing about costuming. I'm a huge movie watcher. You know, I love movies. I love the magic of movies. Like
yeah.
I was like thinking the other day, like if someone gave me the list of how many movies and how much TV time I've logged, I would be horrified. I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
So for me, like, just being able to sort of peek into that was thrilling. But also, like, I started, when I wrote the book, I started writing the first bit of the character. And then the minute she was going to LA, I thought, I don't know where this plot can go until I'm in that world. Because your whole story and plot is, you know, the corridors of that are based on what that world is like, whether they have an archive, how much distance there is between trailers, like how far away are some of the iconic things within a Universal movie set? Can you move a person around quickly enough to do the things that you might want to do? Like, I had no idea what was available to me
right.
in the plot, in the story, until I spent really immersive time with them at Universal Studios with the most generous people who
wow.
spent hours with me just talking about their field.
That's incredible.
It was incredible. I mean, some of it is, you know, it's a large majority of women
right.
who don't get asked about their jobs. You know, they are absolutely low on the totem pole. They're below the line people. And when they do get to talk about their stuff, mostly people want to know about the movie stars and who's difficult and what is the gossip and that kind of thing. But yeah. I wanted to know, like, what are the doorknobs like in the wardrobe trailer? How many steps are there before you step into the spots? Like, what do you do if the shoot goes long? And how do you get people in the right costumes without them screwing it up? Like, and so they were like, I think they felt like, oh, thank God someone's probably interested in us and speaking our language. I mean, they said that. So we had no trouble getting them. I had like six or eight of them out. We were all sitting around eating lunch together. They were talking about the business. It was absolutely fascinating to
me. I've noticed that you're very easy to talk to.
Oh.
So I'm sure they felt the same way.
It was just so much fun. Plus, I was very, very fangirling them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they felt that. They couldn't have not. I was like, just in awe about the whole experience. And then afterwards, I was like, I want to be a costumer. Yeah.
I've never heard of a must hire prior to reading your book.
Yeah. Yep. It's a, I don't know if other professions use it. I imagine they do, because there's a lot of, you know, nepotism in all fields, right?
There is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think anybody that maybe has that is probably called a must hire, but yeah, I'd never heard the word either until they told me it. And I had to ask. I was like, I think my first question was, do they ever hire somebody that's not, you know, can't sew? And they were like, oh, yeah.
Oh, they do all the time.
Yeah, because a lot of producers have daughters and cousins and nieces and lovers that need positions.
Sure.
And so they do it. I think they put them in all kinds of places, not just costume, but everywhere.
Okay.
And so, yeah, there were times like we were sitting around talking one time and they were talking about a must hire.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, it was really fun to know what that meant and who that might be.
Right.
Because they have a lot of stories about people that are hired that are not trained for the positions. And then, you know, some of them work out and some of them don't.
Right.
Yeah. That's why there was that sort of disdain for her must hire position.
Yes. I did recognize that when I was reading your book.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was fascinated with the details of Los Angeles and appreciated how you contrasted the West Coast with the Midwest. And I guess I imagine after talking to you now that was easier to do, as you mentioned, because you were there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so I moved, like I said, I moved from New Jersey, an hour out of New York City, to White Pine, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, which was an hour away from a JCPenney's.
Oh.
And I was in sixth grade. And you know that sixth grade is, you know, you're not quite at puberty and you look weird.
It's a hard age.
Yeah, it's a really hard age. Yeah. And I looked the weirdest because, you know, I had this really dark hair and everybody else was very like Norwegian or Finnish looking, you know. And so I just shut up for a year. And I think that's when I became a writer, only in so much as that a writer is an observer.
Oh.
And I just learned to observe.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I got to see very clearly how they're different and I'm different and to stop being so different. You know?
Okay. I do understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed the friendship that Poppy and Chelsea exhibited throughout the book. Every girl needs a friend like Chelsea. Let's discuss the characters in your book.
Okay.
I like the name Three. How did you come up with that name?
You know, a friend of mine has a friend whose name is Three, and he's the third in a row of people.
Oh.
And I just kept thinking about how that could be kind of a cross to bear, you know?
Yeah.
And especially if the name's not such a great name, like Blatterman was not a great name for Hollywood.
Sure.
So I just sort of adopted that because I loved the idea of it, giving him that kind of hard thing. Yeah. So I stole it.
Okay. And I was surprised by the turn of events that happened with Three.
Yeah. I really wanted to write an idea of, you know, that some of the things that we struggle with in life are based on, you know, some of the relationships that we had when we were younger. And sometimes we engage in those relationships again without really understanding them later on in life.
Right.
And Three was a really good opportunity to make a mirror between her and her father's narcissism.
Okay.
And it was fun to kind of have her slowly sort of realize the similarities between those two people after she had her feet sort of pushed to the fire, you know?
Right, yes. I found myself wondering if you were Poppy in your book.
Yeah, well, I certainly could be Poppy in the book because I can be overly pleasing and a little bit over-responsible. But I think Poppy is a little bit more of a bumbler than I am and doesn't have quite the same amount of, like, surety to move forward. But yeah, certainly in my younger life, I think, you know, when I was younger, definitely I would say that. And I think that she's one of those universal, you know, people-pleasing people that we know so many of.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
they're just lovely, but also a little bit ticked that they're such a people-pleaser.
Yes,
but
yes.
Takes them a little while to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah.
There was an unexpected twist with Poppy and Alan Carroll, who is an ill-tempered movie star. When writing the book, did you envision this twist, or did it occur as you were writing?
Yeah, you know, I did. It occurred while I was writing it. When I was thinking about who might enjoy Poppy and all of her Midwestern ways, all of her fresh, naive take, I thought it might be this person who has been inundated with the sort of machinations of Hollywood. And I thought, well, he would probably be the one that wouldn't hate her quite so much or be so irritated with her as other people. Like, I wanted to show there were these great things about her that, you know, like...
He recognized those things.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah, he recognized them. And I think, you know, people-pleasing is put down all the time as though, you know, it's the worst possible thing you can have. And in some ways, yeah, it can really get in the way of your life.
Right.
But being considerate and kind to people and being careful not to, you know, make their lives harder is also part of people-pleasing.
You're right.
It's like a continuum, right? Like, you're too much of a people-pleaser and it's bad and controlling and you make your lives miserable. But a little bit is just sort of a loveliness that you have for other people.
Right.
And I think he recognized that part. Although he did recognize some of the other stuff too and was irritated with her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You had another character, Robin, who was going to school to become a nurse. Does the character Robin resemble one of your daughters?
You know, not really, because I do have a nurse who's a daughter, but she is like, she is steady as she goes. Like, that girl is a solid, like, you're the one, she's the one you want to be a nurse. Like, if she comes in, you're going to live. And my other one is a little bit maybe more like her, but not quite. Like, I think that she was a little bit younger and more clueless than even my kids were, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, a little bit. So I think maybe not quite the same, you know? But certainly, they both inform that character.
Okay.
You know, they both inform the character of what it's like to be a mother. And I am, you know, a single mom and was for many years. And so I know exactly how to write that.
Right.
I know how to write a
that
married...
That came through in the book, too.
Yeah. I know how to write a married woman as well, but maybe an unhappy married woman. Sorry.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
You know... So, it was an easy thing to write that relationship. I kind of love writing that relationship.
Would you do some readings from the book?
Yeah, I'd happy to.
And while you're getting that, I'm going to just let our audience know that I'm speaking with Anne Garvin about her book titled There's No Coming Back From This. I'm your host, Lisa Malowski, and you are listening to WRT 89.9 FM. I love being one of the Madison BookBeat hosts. And I'm enjoying my time today with Anne Garvin.
Should I read the beginning of the first chapter?
I would love for you to read what resonates with you.
Oh, okay. I'll start with the first chapter.
Okay.
I think it's probably a good spot to go. How far would you like me to read?
Well, I do have a lot more for you.
I'll just read a couple of pages.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Just
thank
so
you.
People can kind of get the voice.
Okay,
then, sure. Okay. So chapter one, Team Lively. I half jogged, half walked to catch up with my 17-year-old daughter in Chicago O'Hare's airport, giving myself a pep talk. You are good at pivoting. You are the pivot. Be the pivot. I dodged a drug-sniffing dog who lifted his head as I slid by. For all I knew, my nervous energy could be detected and I'd be labeled as a threat to national security. If I was detained and strip searched, my ungroomed body hair alone would trigger alarms. No one would be the same after that, and that was the last thing in the world I wanted, the very last thing. If I kept my anxiety in check, my secret stowed, Robin would spend her summer unaware of the mess I'd made of our lives. By the time she returned for college, I'd have a solid plan for the IRS debts, our house back in our name, and money for her to start college. The only evidence of a struggle would be a few gray hairs on my head, which I could dye. Robin, did you weigh your luggage? It costs a ton if it goes over 50 pounds. It's 48, she said over her shoulder. I was careful. Of course, she checked. We were cautious people who didn't like surprises. It was May, and Robin had graduated valedictorian along with 16 other valedictorians, don't get me started. And on graduation day, she'd been brimming with confidence and possibility. Today, though, she looked young and vulnerable. When a neighbor recommended her for a nanny position in the Big Apple, the job sounded like the perfect summer experience before starting nursing school in the fall. Now, faced with the unknowns of a big city, a new family, and 3 solid months away from home, she was like a cat skidding on the slick floor towards a swimming pool. It's normal to be nervous about change, I said, tucking a strand of her silky hair behind her ear. I'm going to miss everything, she said, her brown eyes wide. Robin didn't realize how true that statement was. She'd miss IRS calls where I'd use my high-pitched stress voice begging for dispensation, pleas to the mortgage lender for a loan deferment, and the final gasps of our family business finally being kicked to the curb. She'd miss witnessing her mother trying again and again to get in touch with the accountant who pocketed all our money and applying for jobs that wouldn't make a dent in the debt in time for anything. But I needed to focus on what my daughter was really saying. We weren't talking about me here. She'd miss tubing with her friends for the 100th time, sitting in basements giggling and flirting with the same boys she'd gone to grade school with. High school was over and adulthood was on the way, and I knew she felt that loss, as I did. You'll miss some things, but all of your buddies have a job. Nobody is as free as you imagine. Her best friends were going to be camp counselors, lifeguards, and waitresses at resorts, and Robin would have her own experience away from her mother's failings.
You really did a nice job with that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I was in forensics in high school.
Oh, that came through. You are a nurse. Can you talk to me about your journey from nurse to writer?
Yeah. You know, I'm really not one of those kinds of people that wrote forever, but I was a reader forever.
And
just a huge reader. And also authors were kind of my rock stars.
Were you fiction or nonfiction or
fiction.
Both? Fiction.
Mostly fiction.
Okay.
Yeah. And I always read. And then, but when I was a nurse, like, you'd really understand, you really get a deep idea of who people are at their core because you're seeing them at their absolute worst.
Right.
And so I spent a lot of time like thinking about how to make them feel better, how to give them enough dignity to keep going. Like you really spend a lot of time in psychology. But then, I really wasn't the greatest nurse because you got to give everybody the right meds every single time, no matter what. They're super fussy about it.
Sure.
There were a lot of things in administration that I didn't love. So I went to graduate school and I really never wrote fiction. But then the Wisconsin Book Festival had a contest and I won second place.
I saw that.
And Christy Clancy here in town, she won first place. And that was way back in 2004.
Wow.
And it opened up my mind about, they sent you a piece of artwork and they gave you, just the artwork was the prompt and you had 24 hours to write it. So I had this moment where I was like, you picture something in your head and you write a story about it.
Right.
Like, I thought
what
you had to have a whole idea.
What was the artwork that they gave you?
It was this great picture of like a couple who were embracing in an old timey movie kiosk,
a
lean-to.
Right.
And there was a fence and a big movie screen overhead that was playing a movie.
Okay.
And you could do anything. Like, I know hundreds of people wrote all different stories for that thing. And it was the first time where I was like, oh, you don't have to have a whole book idea. You visualize these scenes like a movie.
Right.
And you write it as you go along.
Uh-huh.
And I think when I got second place, what I got was sort of the idea that my voice was something that might be a good thing to have when you're trying to learn how to write a book. Like there's story and there's style, right?
Right.
And voice is style. And, you know, I'm sure that there are, everybody has a different style and you pick different authors based on their style. I have a very particular style. And
you do.
Yeah.
You do. Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe that contest win was saying your style is okay. Uh-huh. And now you know to think about a visual. So now you have to learn how to write a book. So then I worked on learning how to write a book.
And did you produce a book from that contest?
Not from that short story. No.
Okay.
But I did start. So my first short story, a woman friend of mine said that her mother used to let her daughters play with her wedding dress all the time, like on bikes.
Oh,
like
wow.
Out in the dirt.
Oh.
And I thought,
that's interesting.
That's interesting. It is. That's an interesting story. And so I built my first character around that idea. And she was the mother of the primary character in the first book that I published on Maggie's Watch.
Okay.
So I started to like understand like, oh, these things, these visualizations in my mind are keys to the character of the story, what makes someone interesting in a story, and then how to build a story around that.
And would you say your stories are a little sad but funny?
Yeah.
All of the books?
Them are.
Okay.
Yeah, they all have a little bit of, like, you know, somebody asked me recently, like, what do you mean by funny and sad? And I said, like, in a couple of sentences, you might go, oh. At the same time, like, oh, that's funny, but so
I
sad.
Did that throughout the book.
Yeah.
And yeah. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. What do you miss about being a nurse?
I miss the one-on-one. Okay, this is going to sound, this is going to sound so pandery, but it was the reason that I wanted to be a nurse in the first place. I miss handing someone a glass of water and making them feel better.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's why I wanted to be a nurse in the first place. I miss that. I miss that day-to-day connection with people that don't feel great.
Good answer.
Yeah.
What do you like about being a writer?
Here's what I love. Like, I get notes from people sometimes that will say, oh, I just love that book. It made me laugh, and I felt better after reading it. And, you know, that I'm that person, and I sort of get it now. And that's, I think, what I like the best is that, like, when I started to write, you know, I did a lot of research over the years and published a lot of academic research in exercise and mental health. But, you know, nobody really read that stuff.
Or if they did, they didn't write you a note about it.
They certainly didn't. Yeah. Or, you know, they built their own research about and around it using it as a thing. But no one, like, I just felt like if I was able to write a book, like, maybe there'd be a larger net that I could cast to help people live their lives, you know, in a certain way. So that's kind of what I love about it. But I also love the freedom of being able to make up these stories. And I love meeting other authors.
Yes.
Like that is a dream for me.
I can say that even when I interview other authors, I love it. There's nothing
like it.
It is the greatest.
I know.
It's almost as though you're riding on a horse while you're doing the interview.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel that
it's exhilarating.
Way. Yeah.
Some may say that a nurse engages more with the left brain, which is analytical, calculated, and orderly, versus the right brain, which is supposed to be intuitive and creative. With this, there is also the thought that the nurse must step to the right of their left brains in order to be both data-minded and people-focused. Where do you stand on this issue?
You know, it's such an interesting thing. I thought about it a lot because I do seem to have both of those areas in my brain sort of have an ability to thrive, both of those. And, you know, there's a lot of analytical stuff that goes into a lot of detail-oriented things that going into writing a book. But here's what I would say. I get energy from the emotions of people and people. And so the creative part of that is the most fun for me. I can do the other stuff well, but I don't nearly get as much fun and enjoyment in it as I do the writing fiction and making up stories and making people laugh and things like that. Like, I think it's a joy thing for me. I could do both, but the joy comes from the creativity more than the, you know, like, so, yeah. 'Cause I imagine people that are like, love programming, I bet they get a lot of joy from it, like flow.
Right, right.
I don't get that. It's a lot of work for me. Right. I got to focus and then I got to take a nap.
Right.
But with this, I got to focus, I take a nap, but I'm a happier napper then. You know?
Like, yes, I like that answer too. Yeah. Wanted to let the audience know again that I'm speaking with Anne Garvin about her book titled There's No Coming Back From This. I'm your host, Lisa Malowski, and you're listening to WRT 89.9 FM. So, Anne, I was also going to ask you about how you founded Tall Poppy Writers. I read that Tall Poppy Syndrome is a term commonly used in Australia,
mm-hmm.
referring to the expectation that poppies, hard workers, should grow together. And if one grows too tall, it is cut down to size. In the workplace, a study explored whether women were like poppies, cut down to minimize their success. You flipped the term on its head. The Tall Poppy Writers are committed to helping everyone succeed, to celebrating and encouraging accomplishment and achievement. TPW is a place where everyone gets to grow as tall as they are able. Can you talk to me more about Tall Poppy Writers?
Yeah. So when my first book came out, I was right in the middle of my divorce happened on the same day, and then I also had pneumonia. And I thought, you know what? I'm never going to sell any books like this. This is nuts. And I thought, I just think that's crazy. There's all kinds of women probably in the exact same position as me. They are working as single mothers, or their jobs are full time, mm-hmm. and they maybe want their voice to be heard. But and the thing that's so frustrating is in the publishing industry, if you don't sell books, you don't get another book.
Right.
And so if you have pneumonia mm-hmm. and a divorce and children, your chances of getting another book are reduced. And the problem with that is that it really inhibits your voice getting strong enough and sure enough and heard.
Right.
And I can't bear that. Like, I spent my life in male-dominated careers, like nursing with physicians, and in sure. science, all my mentors were men. And
right.
then I worked in a professor situation where mostly I worked with men. And there is a lot of competition that goes against the genders or between the genders, but also within the gender. And it just drives me crazy. So I thought, I'm going to put together a group of women who are committed to this kind of thing so that we all have a tribe and we can all escalate each other's work, so that if something happens, if one of us gets sick, the rest of the women can kind of join in and help. And it is such an amazing group of women. They are...
How many are you?
There's 30. I think there's 42 now, which is on the high end for me to be able to manage. But I have a COO. Her name is Stephanie Burns, and she is really helps me keep things going. But they, like, we have, if somebody gets sick or somebody, you know, during a launch date or something, everybody really works hard to show up for whatever it is they need.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's a, you know what that's like, it's a hard thing to find that in the world.
Very hard.
Yeah. And so over the, we've been around now since, I don't know, like 13, 14 years or something now.
Are the women from all over?
Yeah. We have across genre, so all kinds of genre, and also all kinds of diversity. So, and we're the only group. All the other author groups that you see tend to be, if you're traditionally published, you know, historical fiction or romance,
yeah.
or, and they're you know, set like that. And but we have really tried to focus on bringing all kinds of diversity, because we believe that everybody kind of reads. I read everything. Like,
yeah,
I read
too.
All kinds of things.
Right.
And so we believe that, you know, talking about these books and getting everybody, there's no downside of it, really.
Oh, that's great.
And one of us, you know, if one of us does really well, they're hauling us along with it because they mention us and uh-huh. people look into us. And so, yeah, it's been kind of a port in the storm, I think, for the poppies. We've had a lot of changeover. Some people have left the business. Some people have put a pause on their careers and they're welcome back. So there's a lot of ways to do it. But I started it with Erin Solello, the author here in town, and Susan Gloss. And they both have, you know, paused a little bit in their careers. Their children are in that age where you spend the entire time in your van. And but they, when I pitched it to them, I was like, look, you guys, I think they were doing it. They're like, yes, totally, let's do it. And then they were both like, but we're pregnant. So it was like, it started very slowly and has grown and grown. And it's really one of the things that keeps me writing.
If there was someone listening right now that wanted to know how to join Tall Poppy Writers, what would you recommend?
Well, one of the things that we say is we do have some qualifications, like you have to be traditionally published and you have to have a couple of books under tow. But the best way to get in it is get to know poppies over a year or two, because you get brought in by making relationships with the poppies. We do it all on referral now.
Okay.
We don't have an application per se because we don't have the staff. Like, we have no staff. It's just me and Stephanie, and we are writing books all the time. But but we do have a couple of Facebook books and an Instagram, and so that is the best way to interact with the authors.
Okay.
And so the Facebook group is called Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, and I think you can find it by going to RU in Bloom. But you can find it. It's the Tall Poppy Writers in Bloom. And then in Instagram, it's just the Tall Poppy Writers. And that's really the best way for people to get to know us.
Right.
And after a fair amount of time, like, it takes a while, because we want people to have a genuine desire to be one of us for the long term, and not somebody that's just like, oh, I have a book coming out, I want to be the poppies, and then they'll disappear, because we've had a lot of that.
I could see that.
Yeah, I could too. I don't blame people. I get it.
Right.
It's a commitment. You know?
I was going to ask, was the name of Poppy and There's No Coming Back from This derived from Tall Poppy Writers?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know why. I tried to change it. I tried to change her name, and I just couldn't change it.
You were stuck with it.
Yeah, I was stuck with it. And I liked the idea of Poppy Lively because it was so ridiculous. You know?
I like that too. I mean, it jumped at you.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little ridiculous, but I like it because it just underscores who she is.
Yeah.
Even though she doesn't know she's really that person.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You have established a strong following over the years. The Kindle edition of There's No Coming Back from This was an Amazon First Reads for July and is a number one bestseller on Amazon in the general humorous fiction category. I know that you give your agents, editors, and Lake Union Publishing a lot of credit for this. You were 50 years old when your first book came out. Talk to me about your book journey.
It's been a journey, as all authors have a different story. I started out at Penguin Random House, and I published two books with them. And then they didn't take my third book. So I went to a very small independent publisher who was... It was great, though. It was Tyrus Books, and the Ben Leroy was my editor, and he lived in Madison. Just sort of weirdly. And the company was owned by Writer's Digest and a larger portion. But then Simon & Schuster bought that book and bought the rights to it. So Simon & Schuster owns that. So it was a small publisher. I did make the USA Today bestseller list, but... You know, the sales were okay, but not enough to have Simon & Schuster say, yeah, we want you to come back.
Right.
So it was a tough time there. I left my agent, and I've had a couple of different agents. Some have just left the business.
Okay.
And I was grandfathered into somebody else's, you know, I don't know what they call it, portfolio.
Right.
And then I found a different agent, and then I left her because I just wasn't sure she was doing what I needed her to do. And then I wrote a couple of books, and I couldn't sell them. And then I pitched an agent at one of the MFAs that I was teaching at Miami, Ohio. And you know what? It was very interesting. He's like, well, I like the idea of both of those books, but what you really should do is become a Tall Poppy writer. And I said, well, I am that. I'm the person that started that. And he said...
Oh, he didn't realize that? That's really interesting.
It was interesting. And so then he said, okay, great. He said, so I'll take a look at your books, but I had a little trouble. Like, he was not really the perfect agent for me either. So I was given to another woman who really was the right agent for me. And then I wanted to go to Lake Union specifically because I knew that they were going to do the yeoman's work of publicity. And that's a very, it's so hard, even with the tall poppy writers, it's so hard because the world is so noisy.
Right.
And I wanted to go with them, and they have been incredible to work with. Like, they're just incredible to work with. They're so author-centered, and they are so communicative. They give you a ton of support, and they get your book out in front of readers.
That's great.
Yeah, they were great. I mean, I don't feel great about everything related to it just because indie bookstores don't love an Amazon imprint because an Amazon imprint is in competition with their sales.
Right.
And I understand that. I don't argue with that. I understand it.
Right.
And I don't love that because indie bookstores have been in my life forever. And the indie bookstores in Madison have been so wonderful to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel it from them at all. But there are other bookstores that are really just not interested in. I get it. So there's that piece of it that sort of breaks my heart. But the rest of it, just getting in front of readers and having them do the work so that I can write another book, mm-hmm. that's a dream come true for me.
That's
wonderful.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I can't say enough about them, honestly.
What is the number one thing you like about marketing your book?
I love to meet readers face-to-face, even if it's on a Zoom.
Uh-huh.
Like, I mean, they're my people, right?
Right.
And they're the kind of people that, you know, if you were stuck on a boat with a bunch of people that were readers, you would never run out of things to say.
Right.
And so when I'm with those people, it's like all lights go on, you know? Mm-hmm. So when I get invited to book clubs, even if it's sometimes what I usually do will invite them to my house because that's so fun having them come into the house.
And,
and then we, you know, we'll have a picnic outside or something like that. Like, I love that. So I think that's the number one thing. Like, I am not, you know, I'm on TikTok in the worst of ways. Like, I'm terrible on it. I'm a Midwesterner. I don't want to go, you should buy this. You know, it's really hard for me. And also, I came from the generation of people that are like, it's rude to talk about money and buying things.
Right.
Like, I feel rude about it.
Right.
So I don't love any of that.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to get people interested in you by not saying, well, you have to read the whole book for you to get it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So it's hard for me to do that. But once a reader or readers or book clubs find me, that's sort of my sweet spot. I love that so much.
Very nice. What's the thing that you hate about promoting your book?
The buy my thing. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a tricky thing, right? Because everybody only has a limited amount of money.
Right.
And you're saying, this is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is or it isn't. It may not be for them.
Right.
And they may not like it. They might, but they might not. And I don't know. It's very hard to get someone. You're asking them to prioritize the hard work that they do.
Right.
Talk about it in a financial way. Like, I have trouble with that. I just suck at that.
Right.
You know, I would be terrible at selling. Like, I for a very brief period of time, literally 3 days, I worked at selling vacuum cleaners
mm-hmm.
when I was in high school. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't walk into somebody's house and going, you really need this.
Right.
It's a $600 vacuum.
Yes.
And I struggle with that. Talking about money is always uncomfortable, I think.
Yes,
and
it is.
A request to have somebody buy something is, I hate it.
Yeah.
I wish I could get over that. You know, I wish I could get over that.
I wanted to share with the audience that you will be back on Madison BookBeat on October 28th for your new book, Bummer Camp.
Yeah.
And we'll be live in the studio at that point.
Oh, good.
Yes.
I just found out that date has been changed to the launch of it will be like September 17th. So it'll be closer to our interview.
Oh,
time.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
that'll great. Be great.
And did you want to read a little bit more out of your book?
I could pick up where I left off.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And that'll give the audience an ideal, better idea of your book.
Okay.
And just wanted to say that I'm speaking with Ann Garvin about her new book titled There's No Coming Back From This. I'm your host, Lisa Malowski, and you're listening to WRT 89.9 FM.
Okay, I'll start right where she's talking to her daughter about what she'll miss online.
Great.
So Robin would have her own experience away from her mother's failings. "I could help you put the business online," she said. "If I stayed, I'd have more time to pack for school. Maybe work in a nursing home instead of going so far away." Robin's face flushed. "I'll miss you so much, Mom." "I'll be right here when you return. Everything will be the same as when you left." And there it was. Two simple sentences uttered as if they weren't a vow. Two promises I knew I'd do everything in my power to keep. The irony on which my future hung, at least my future as a person who didn't live in a federal prison, was this. I'd hired an accountant to help during Robin's busy final years of high school. I'd agreed to chair committees, host dinners, be present, helpful mother. I knew that Donna Klump, CPA, wanted a wine fridge and a trip to Turks and Caicos, but what I didn't know was that she refused to pay my taxes and pocketed the cash to get them. Now, the IRS had unceremoniously drained my every bank account and Robin's college accounts to pay the bursar's office. Oops, to pay federal business and property taxes. On top of all of that, the university's bursar's office needed a down payment to hold my daughter's place in nursing school, and state business and property tax liens were sure to come. Robin glanced at me uncertainly. Maybe she felt my energy dip. So I beamed support and said, "Go on, honey, step up to the counter." And I watched her move to check in. A large man with an enormous set of Louis Vuitton luggage stepped in front of her, and I suppressed a violent urge to haul him back by the collar. "It's okay, honey. Just let him go ahead. You're next," I said, and gestured her forward. Getting Robin in the air was the only thing that kept me from calling any and all hotlines and hyperventilating. I knew I'd have trouble fixing my finances with her watching and wondering how I'd let everything fall apart. I couldn't bear that she might experience all the insecurity I'd had as a child. While Robin hefted her luggage onto the scale and handed the Delta agent her ID, I surreptitiously breathed into the neck of my shirt like a paper bag. 48 pounds, Robin said with a thumbs up. I blew an entirely overly juicy raspberry of release, wiped my mouth, and smiled.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could you tell the audience where they can find you? I know you're on Facebook, Twitter.
I am. In fact, Instagram is probably my best spot right now.
Okay.
It's at Ann Garvin with an underscore.
Sure.
Facebook is great, but I get overwhelmed by Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And so I tend to post mostly in Instagram, but then it posts up to my author page on Facebook. And you can find that through Ann Garvin, or Ann Wertz Garvin is my personal page. So either way.
Perfect.
But the best thing probably for people is to sign up for my newsletter, which nobody wants to do, and I get it. But I only send out one email a month, and I always provide one original essay that's not published anywhere.
Is it a free newsletter?
It's free, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And then within that newsletter is all the news that you might want, like when I do a retreat, or if I'm going to Europe and bringing writers there or readers there.
Oh, wow.
Or if it's if there are books launching from the Tall Poppy Writers, they all go in there so that you'll know.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, when people's books are coming out. And that's probably the best spot. And like I said, I only get my act together to do it once a month, so it doesn't show up in your email.
And when you say essay, it's an essay that you write?
Yeah, I write an essay, a little personal essay about something.
Very nice.
Yeah. Like last week, I think it was just about being busy.
Okay.
You know, and apologizing. Or sometimes I wrote an essay about once my parents died, what my dead dad thinks now versus what maybe he thought before.
Right.
You know, little things that I think are a little funny and sad in people's lives.
Right, right. That's it for this conversation. You've been listening to Madison BookBeat, a weekly show highlighting local authors and authors coming to town. I've been your host, Lisa Malowski. My guest has been Ann Garvin. Her new book is There's No Coming Back From This. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Andrew Thomas for running the soundboard today. Thanks to Shelley Pittman, News and Talk Director, and Jade Iseri Ramos, Talk Producer. Stay tuned for 3 hours of jazz on All Around Jazz with Alex Wilding White. But first, the Insurgent Radio Kiosk. You're listening to Community Radio, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio coming to you from the heart of Madison, Wisconsin. You just heard Madison Bookbeat. Coming up next is 3 hours of all-around jazz with Alex Wilding White. But before that, you will be hearing the Insurgent Radio Kiosk. So stay tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Its listener sponsors and ResTech services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 25th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions, this week in music history for March 25th. On March 24th, 1992, Arrested Development's debut album, 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of, was released. One way to get a greater perspective on history is to look at music. When indigenous Africans were stolen from their native lands, not only was their physical freedom taken away, their spiritual freedom was supplanted by Christianity. Their cultural music, drums in particular, was banned and replaced with gospel, which, although heavily influenced by ancestral African music, was all about praising the Christian God. The language of the soul is music. So, in effect, not only were the people physically enslaved, they lost touch with their souls as well. Years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of explored these ideas, and although several songs reference the Christian God, the track Fishing for Religion shows that they question Christianity.
When they want change, the preacher says shout it. The shout bring about change, I doubt it. All shout does is make you lose your voice.
The majority of the songs were in contrast to the gangster rap that was popular at the time, with songs about love, kindness, and reconnecting with the earth. The music is beat heavy with lots of melodic catchy tape loops and is very danceable. It's amazing to think that this album was released 22 years ago, but it does seem like we are moving in the direction of erasing or at least blurring the lines inside the Venn diagram of music, religion, and race. Also this week, March 25th, 1942, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, is born. March 25th, 1957, Elvis Presley buys the Graceland Mansion for, any guesses? $102,500. That was this week, years ago. Let's learn from the past and do our future selves a favor by doing the right thing today.